when Yom Tov falls out on Shabbos, the Yom Tov sort of, the Shabbos makes way for the Yom Tov, and we read what we would normally read on the Yom Tov, which is part of the Chumash, has to do with Yom Tov, whatever the case is. Normally on the second, on the last day Yom Tov, read a piece from Parshas Ra'eh in Dvarim. Okay. Interestingly enough, this year we have one of the, it does happen once in a while, we have one of the interesting complications, where in Israel there is a Parsha. Because this Shabbos is not the second day Yom Tov in Israel, it's just Parshas Nosai. So what happens is, this week on Shabbos it's Parshas Nosai for us, it's before for Israel, it's not Parshas Nosai for us. Which means that next week it's Parshas Nosai for us and Parshas Baal Loischa for Israel. Okay, now this happens. It happens particularly with Shavuos, because the second day, it sometimes happens with Pesach also when the last day is Shabbos. What happens is we're actually out of sync for a number of weeks until the next time we have a possibility of a double Parsha, which is Chukas Bolak. So what will happen is, Bachukas Bolak, is that they will read it as separate parshas, and we'll read it on a double parsha, Chukas Bolak, and we'll catch up. Right? But it's an interesting concept that for a good few weeks, we actually, the parsha of the week is different depending where you're living.
So if you're traveling, you're going to
listen. So traveling is an interesting thing. I traveled a number of years ago. It was actually Baal Lois for Shlach, exactly this happened. I was in Israel, and normally, it depends where you are. Normally, if you're in Yerushalayim, there's hundreds of people who have come from overseas. So the minyan that I went to happened to be Shabbos morning. That particular minyan, davening at Tzemach Tzedek in the Old City, when it came time for lining, they split into two. And they read the Israeli minyan, and then had what they call chutz minyan, like a minyan for people who came from Chutz Laretz who had to catch up. But what was interesting was, I think it was Baal Loischa and Shlach, those were the two parshas. The ones from Chutz Laretz, I never actually found out why they did this, but I imagine the reason is this, because they didn't, the one Chutz La'aretz didn't just do the Chutz La'aretz one. What they did was, they did both. Like they did the Chutz La'aretz one, for the first Aliyah, they read the whole Chutz La'aretz one, plus the first Aliyah of the Israeli one, and then kept going like the Israeli system. And I think the reason is because you can't just come to Israel and then have a different minyan with a different parsha. But because we hadn't heard that previous parsha yet, so we needed to catch up, so that's why they kind of did both.
Right. And if you're not in Yerushalayim and somewhere where it's not going to have a chutz,
then you don't have.
Just miss out.
Yeah.
But there's nothing you can do.
Just miss out. Right.
Can I just ask, if it's still Shavuos on Shabbat, you're supposed to have milk or meat or both?
For that you have to come to the halacha shiur tonight. Just kidding. but the quick answer is, no. The main minhag of eating milk foods is on the first day, not the second day.
The day or the night?
Day. The main custom of eating milk is the day. There are some people eat the night as well, but the main custom of eating is during the day after davening. Okay? Okay. So, there's no parsha this week, it's just a Yom Tov reading. However, I'm happy that you have a Chumash out of you, because what I want to do is I want to focus on Shavuos and on Matan Torah and on the part of the Chumash where we read about Matan Torah, about the giving of the Torah. Okay? Which is in Parshas Yisro. And the reason why this is so important is because what we have to understand is that when we read about the Parsha, about giving of the Torah on the first day Shavuos, like everything in Yiddishkeit, but particularly with this, it's not just an issue of history, it's reliving the experience, and what we believe is, and what we understand and appreciate is that every Shavuos, we receive the Torah once again. In other words, it's a reenactment of that experience, right? And this is actually brought out in a very beautiful thought that the Sfas Emes says. Have a look on page, just after the Ten Commandments. That says at Dibris, if you have a look on page 412. Okay.
Where
are we looking? Yeah. If you look at 412, Pasuk Tesvav, that's verse 15, right? Just after it finishes the Ten Commandments, the Torah continues on with a description of how the giving of the Torah actually took place. And it says, V'chol ha'om Ro'im es hakoilos es alapidim es kol ha'shofar es ha'horashtei, and the whole nation saw the voices, the thunder, the lightning, the voice of the shofar, and the smoking mountain. Vayar ha'am vayanu, the nation saw and they shook, they trembled. Vayamdu merochak, and they stood at a distance. Right? Now, if you have a look at the article translation there in 15, it says the entire people saw the thunder and the flames. Right? Saw in the past tense. But if you have a look at the Hebrew, that's actually not what it says. Right? It's a contextual translation, but it's not a literal translation. Mm-hmm. Because what it actually says is, V'chol ha'am ro'im es ha'koilos. The whole nation sees. In Hebrew, saw, in the past tense, is ra'u. They saw. Right? Or, like the second part of the pasuk, Vayar ha'am, or he saw. Right? Ra'im is sees, not saw. So the Sfas Emes picks up on this point. He says, what does it mean, and the whole nation sees the lightning? And he says, this pasuk is coming to remind us that the experience of Matan Torah takes place every year. And if you access and you connect to the whole concept of the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah every year, then it's not the whole nation saw, but it's the whole nation sees. And it happens in the present, and you connect to the dramatic revelation that took place at Har Sinai, you can connect that every single year in the present tense, not only in the past tense, right? So that's why it's so important every year when comes Shavuos to sort of understand a little bit what the giving of the Torah is all about and to try and connect the whole concept once again. Now, just to give you a bit of a historic background so you understand what actually took place. The festival of Shavuos, right, that we celebrate the giving of the Torah. Interestingly enough, halachically, it's actually not connected with the giving of the Torah. In the Torah, it does not say we should celebrate Shavuos to commemorate the giving of the Torah, like it does by Pesach. Right? In the Torah, it says that you should count the Omer from the second day of Pesach, count 49 days, and on the 50th day, you should keep Shavuos. Literally speaking, from the Torah, the Yontif of Shavuos is actually more of a celebration about completing the Omer than it is about giving of the Torah. Right, just from a historic point of view, from a malachic point of view. In fact, the Gemara says, you see, Shavuos is a very interesting yontif. Shavuos doesn't have a date in the Torah, I don't know if you realize that. Right, every other yontif has a date. Pesach is supposed to be on the 15th of Nisan, Sukkot is on the 15th of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah on the 1st of Tishrei, etc. Shavuos doesn't have a date. Shavuos is on the 50th day of the Omer. Now, nowadays, that always means it's on the 6th of Sivan. But it didn't always mean that. Because in the time of the Mishnah, in a time when Jews would have the calendar in a very different way, what they would do is they would affix the calendar on a month-by-month basis based on the testimony of the witnesses that would come and say they saw the moon, right? It wasn't like we have today a set structure where certain months are 29 days and certain months are 30 days. The way it used to happen there was that, depending on the month, sometimes it was 30 days, sometimes it was 29 days. Depending on if witnesses came, if they saw the moon, they didn't see the moon, on what the Sanhedrin decided to do that month, etc. Right? So if Shavuos doesn't have a date, but Shavuos has to be on the 50th day of the Omer, the Gemara actually says that it could happen that Shavuos should fall out on the 5th of Sivan. If both Nisan and Iyar have 30 days, then it would be earlier, you'd finish the Omer earlier. It could happen if they both had 29 days, that Shavuos would be on the 7th of Sivan. And it could be like nowadays where it's the 6th of Sivan. So it actually didn't have a set date those days. Right? Which meant that it didn't always fall out on the anniversary of the giving of the Torah, you realize. Right? Now even nowadays, where it does fall out on the 6th of Sivan, not everyone agrees that Matan Torah actually took place on the 6th of Sivan. I think I've mentioned this concept before, but it's an amazing idea that the one event that was the defining experience of the Jewish nation, we're actually not quite sure when it happened. You realize that? It's an amazing thing. This is the most important event in Jewish history is Matan Torah. There's no question about that. That defines us halachically, defines us historically, defines us philosophically. Our definition as a nation of Yidden takes place at Matan Torah. Every single day in davening, when we say Hashem chose us from all nations, the Shulchan Aruch says, we're supposed to have in mind that we're talking about the giving of the Torah. That's when God chose us as a nation. That's where halachically, on all levels, we became a nation. All mitzvahs we keep, even the ones that were given before Matan Torah, the Rambam is very clear that we only keep them because they were given at Matan Torah. Even non-Jews, in fact, even their definition comes from Matan Torah. You know, non-Jews are obligated to keep the 7 Noachad laws. If a non-Jew wishes to keep the 7 Noachad laws properly, he has to keep them not just to observe them, but he's got to keep them because they were taught by Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. Very interesting idea. Not because they were given to Adam or to Noach, but because they were given at Har Sinai. Because Har Sinai defines existence. And yet, it's the one event that we actually don't know when it happened. It doesn't say in the Torah when it happened. We have to work it out, and because we have to work it out, there's a whole dispute. And the Gemara says that everyone agrees that the Jews arrived at Har Sinai on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, on the first of Sivan. Everyone agrees, because we interpret the Pesukim, that the Torah was given on Shabbos. We just don't know when Rosh Chodesh Sivan was. Rav Yossi says it was Sunday, and therefore the giving of the Torah was on the 7th of Sivan. And the rabbis say it was on the 6th of Sivan, because Rosh Chodesh Sivan was actually on a Monday. Right? Working backwards, depending on when they went out of Egypt, the whole complicated story. Until today, it's an unresolved issue. Not all opinions agree of how we actually resolve this issue. Some opinions hold that it was the 7th of Sivan, some hold it was the 6th of Sivan. Not quite sure. There's actually a very important, it seems uncomfortable, but there's a very important lesson behind this, by the way. The reason that the Torah is not, we don't know when it was exactly, is because Torah transcends time. And we're not supposed to designate Torah to a particular time. We're supposed to understand that the Torah's relevance is transcends time. Right? Transcends time and transcends space, which is also why it was given in the desert. Now, the Torah was given in the desert on a day that we're not quite sure when it was. Because a desert is a place halachically where if you find something that the Gemara says it's ownerless, you can keep it, doesn't belong to anyone, right? And not knowing which day it is means it transcends time. So Torah transcends time and space. Right? Which is why also the Torah is not designated to particular people. I told the story on this past Friday night. I might have told it here before. My grandpa told me the story once. He had the schus once to see the Chafetz Chaim. So what happened was, he was studying in Yeshiva in Vilna, and him and a chavrusa, the Chafetz Chaim, came to town. So him and his chavrusa decided to go and see the Chafetz Chaim. At that time, the Chafetz Chaim was a little older, and he was a little bit hard of hearing. So he would come with his son-in-law, and his son-in-law would help people interpret, etc. So they came into the Chafetz Chaim, and they asked the son-in-law to ask the Chafetz Chaim, that they're two young yeshiva students, they'd like a bracha from the Chafetz Chaim. Now you have to understand, the Chafetz Chaim was, at that time, the Chafetz Chaim was not a Hasidic rebbe, the Chafetz Chaim was a Lithuanian gadol. And particularly in those times, nowadays it's a bit different because the lines have been blurred a little bit, but in those days, giving brachas was a Hasidic thing to do. You know, Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva didn't give brachas. It wasn't they taught Torah, they taught halacha, but it wasn't their thing to give brachas. So different approaches. So the son-in-law said to the Chafetz Chaim, these two young students want a bracha. So Chafetz Chaim started to laugh. What bracha? It's not my thing. I don't give brachas. So the son-in-law had Rahman, his son, these two young Yeshiva students. My grandfather was one of them. He said to the Chafetz Chaim, two young guys, give them a bracha. Like, don't just, you know. So Chafetz Chaim said, okay, I'll give you a bracha. The bracha goes like this, he said. He said, the Mishnah says that there's three crowns. The Jewish people were given three crowns. One crown is called the Keser Kahuna, the crown of priesthood, the Kohanim. The crown of Malchus, the crown of sovereignty. And the crown of Torah, Keser Torah. That were the three crowns, right? Shlosh Aksar. So he said in Yiddish, but he based it on a Mishnah, obviously, because the Mishnah says something similar, but he said in Yiddish like this. He says, the Keser Kahuna, the crown of Kahuna, hot ki chapt Aaron. Aaron ha-Kohen chapt it. In other words, it's designated for his family, and you have to be a descendant of Aaron to be a Kohen. You can't become a Kohen, you can't buy Kohen, you can't acquire Kohen, it doesn't work out, you can't convert to a Kohen. Kohen is a Kohen, finish. You have to be a descendant of Aaron. So that was chapt by Aaron and his family. Keser Malchus, he said, the crown of kingship, of sovereignty, had kichap David HaMelech. So King David, ultimately, once David HaMelech became the king, there's no true halachic king in the Jewish nation other than David HaMelech, and even Mashiach, who will be a king, will have to come from David HaMelech. He said, however, the crown of Torah, no one chapt. So he said, my bracha to you is, he says, Geitun chapt. He says, go and chapt the crown of Torah. That was his bracha. He said, go and chapt the crown of Torah. Right? But it's the same idea, that the that the crown of Torah is universal. The crown of Torah has no space, has no time, has no exclusion. Everyone is connected to Torah. Everyone can study Torah. Everyone can connect to Torah. So that's why it's an amazing event. There's no real Yom Tov that actually celebrates the giving of the Torah, because the Shavuos is actually more about the Omer. We're not exactly sure when it happened, and it happened in a desert. So for that reason. However, there's no question that if there's one time in the year where we can re-experience the event at Shavuos, as all the commentators say, even if we were to conclude that we celebrate Shavuos on a day that isn't Matan Torah, but it certainly is Matan Torah spiritually, because the conclusion of the Omer and Matan Torah are intertwined. The reason that the Jews received the Torah at the end of counting the Omer, because they were then spiritually ready. Similarly, every single year when we finish counting the Omer, we then spiritually ready, so to speak, for the giving of the Torah. So no question that spiritually speaking, the Yom Tov of Shavuos, of course, is to do with the giving of the Torah, and it's a time to reenact and re-experience the holy event of Matan Torah. Now, the Gemara tells us that one of the key events that happened at Matan Torah was the Jewish commitment of Naaseh V'Nishma. Right? Incidentally, by the way, that is not recorded in the Chumash around the time of the giving of the Torah. It's actually recorded later on in Parshas Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim, Perek Chaf Dalet, chapter 24. Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. That's on page 440. That's right. 440. Just so you understand, the way the Chumash works is like the whole story of giving of the Torah is told in Parshas Yisro, you just saw before. However, there's a chunk of the story that was left to later, and as you know, there's no chronological order to the Torah, so it's Parshas Mishpatim, and then the Torah goes back to the story. But what we're going to read now happened before Matan Torah. So you have a look at verse 7, it says like this. Vayikach Sefer HaBris, Moshe Rabbeinu took the Book of Covenant, the covenant that the Jews were entering in between them and God. Vayikra, which was the preparation for the giving of the Torah. Vayikra ba'aznei ha'am, and he called in the ears of the nation. Vayomru, and they said, this is one of the greatest commitments that the Jews ever made. They said, Kol asher diber Hashem, whatever Hashem will say, has spoken, Naaseh V'Nishma. Right? We will do, and we will listen, or we will understand, we will obey. Right? You don't find it? Okay. Naaseh V'Nishma. Right? At the end of verse 7. Naaseh V'Nishma. We will do, we will obey. V'Nishma, we will listen. Now, even though that's not exactly the actual translation here, but commonly it's always understood that Naaseh means we will obey, we will do. V'Nishma means, and then we will understand. Right? And this was considered one of the greatest things that the Jewish people did. That they said, Naaseh V'Nishma. The Gemara says that when the Jewish people said Naaseh V'Nishma, in other words, Naaseh before Nishma, they committed themselves to be subservient to the will of God even before they would understand. At that moment, 600,000 angels came down, that's what the Gemara tells us, and put on the head of every single Jew two crowns. One crown corresponding to Naaseh, one crown corresponding to Nishma. Okay? So this is the amazing thing. I mean, the Gemara says, the Gemara tells the story, there was one of the great sages that was once trying to understand something in Jewish law, in Halacha, and he was agonizing over the Pshat, couldn't understand the whole thing, and he was trying so hard to understand it, until one of the Romans said to him, he says, "You're a silly nation. Like, why are you trying so hard? It's your fault. You were very hasty. You shouldn't have said Naaseh before Nishma. You should have said, well, I understand first before we just jump into this, right?" And that was just, you know, an indication of what was going on. So, Naaseh V'Nishma. What needs to be understood here? So this was like, this happened on the 5th of Sivan, according to most opinions. And this was the commitment, this was the acceptance phrase of the Jewish people, and considered very, very praiseworthy by God. The question we need to understand with this phrase, Nasa v'nishma, which will give us a little bit of insight into the whole event of the giving of the Torah, is that what part of this phrase is actually so unbelievable? Follow what I'm asking?
Because we'll do without...
Without understanding. Okay. So that's what we'd imagine. That what we do is, in other words, a part of this phrase is that it's Nasa. The Nasa is the most important one. The fact that we pledged to listen to God even though we don't understand. Up to now. And therefore our commitment was demonstrated and reflected by the fact that Nasa came before Nishma. Right? However, if you look closely at the Gemara, that's actually not true. Because the Gemara says that when they said Nasa before Nishma, 600,000 angels came and gave everyone two crowns. One crown for Nasa, one crown for Nishma. Why the two crowns? Why did Nishma deserve a crown? What's so unbelievable about Nishma? In other words, if Nasa is the catchphrase here, if the real emphasis is the fact that they were able to pledge to listen, to obey, without understanding, so really Nasa is the focus here, the word Nasa, and the fact that it comes before the word Nishma, but it's still about the word Nasa, it's not about the word Nishma. Is one following? Yeah. But yet, that's not what the Gemara implies. The Gemara seems to say that, of course, the order was very important. That when they said Nasa before Nishma, they were given a gift. But the gift was not only a gift to praise the word Nasa. The gift was to praise the word Nishma as well. You follow? And that needs to be understood. What's the greatness of Nishma? The greatness of Nasa, we understand. What's the greatness of Nishma? In order to understand this, let's just take another... Let's hold this question, and then let's look at something else. Let's look at the Ten Commandments. Let's look at the very first command. Page 406.
406.
If you look at that Aleph. I'm just looking around. I'm going to share something I shared last night, but no one was there, right? No. I don't like to do that. Okay. So, look at, no, because it's tiring before what I'm going to bring up. Look at Pasuk Aleph, the first verse. It says, Vayedaber Elohim. Oh, you have that down there. And God spoke, it's Kol HaDvarim Elamer, all these things saying. Okay, that was the introductory verse to the Ten Commandments. What's the first command? The first command is, Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God, Asher Hetzisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, that I have taken you out of the land of Egypt, in Beis Avodim, from the house of bondage. That is the first command. So the next pasuk is really the second one of the Ten Commandments. You shall not have other gods, etc. Okay. So what is the mitzvah? What is the mitzvah of Anoichi Hashem Elokecha? You notice the interesting thing? All the other commandments are in instruction format. The language is command, instruction, instructive language. This isn't. This is a statement, not a command. It's a statement, I'm Hashem your God. In fact, interestingly enough, we call them the Ten Commandments, which is a mistranslation. Right? Because it's not Ten Commandments. In fact, if you look at the commands in the Ten Commandments, actually more than Ten Commandments, because there's some ones that subdivide into a few. It says, Aseret HaDibrot, 10 statements, not 10 commandments. Okay? Which ties in with this thing. Actually, this is not even in instructive language. So what actually is going on here? The normally accepted view is that this is the command or the mitzvah of emunah, to believe in the existence of God. Right? I am Hashem your God. I exist. Believe in me. Now, this actually gives rise to a huge debate. And I'll quickly, briefly go through with you the different sides of the debate. There was one of the great Gaonim, he lived around the 9th century, called the Bahag. Right? One of the great halachic writers, philosophic writers. The Bahag writes that emunah, belief in the existence of God, is not a mitzvah. it's not counted as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Why? He's got a good point. He says it cannot be. By definition, it cannot be. What does the word mitzvah mean? Mitzvah means a commandment. Mitzvah, in order for there to be a commandment, as soon as you recognize a commandment, means you've already assumed that there is a mitzaveh, there's a commander. Otherwise, it can't be a commandment. Right? So he says, all of this, we know that there's a number 613. The Gemara says there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. All the 613 mitzvahs, the 248 positive commandments, the 365 negative commandments, what we should do, what we shouldn't do, is all a consequence. The origin of those 613 mitzvahs is the acceptance of the existence of God. Right? So he says that to call belief, to accept that there exists a God, cannot be one of the 613 mitzvahs. It must be the foundation of the 613 mitzvahs. And therefore, he says, when counting and when enumerating and when working out the number 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, you cannot count Anochi Hashem Elokecha, you cannot count Am Hashem your God, as one of the 613 mitzvahs. It's a statement, it's not a mitzvah, it's an assumed foundation before you even start with mitzvahs.
Okay. So if you have a problem with that basic issue, there's no point doing any of the mitzvot, because the mitzvot are coming from Hashem, so you've
correct.
Got to kind of work on
correct.
It first.
Correct. We'll see. You'll see how this develops in a minute. So, logically, he's got a very good point. The problem with it is that it seems to contradict the Gemara. The Gemara says, when the Gemara talks about the number 613, right? The Gemara says a fascinating thing. The Gemara says there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. Now you know that there's a pasuk that says that Moshe Rabbeinu gave us the Torah. What is it? It's a famous pasuk. It says Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. Right? Moshe, it's a pasuk we teach kids to say. But in fact, the Rambam says that when a child talks, learns to talk, you should teach them two psukim: Shema Yisrael and Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. Right. So the Moshe Torah, the Moshe Rabbeinu commanded us the Torah. So the Gemara says an amazing thing. The word Torah has a numerical value, the gematria of 611. So why do we say that Moshe Rabbeinu taught us the Torah? Because Moshe Rabbeinu told us 611 mitzvahs. Because the first two commandments of the Seres HaDibrois, we heard that directly from God. That's a famous idea, that God said the first two commandments. After that, it was too much for us to handle. So the rest of the mitzvahs were taught to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay. But in saying that, what's the Gemara implying? Or what's the Gemara not implying? What's the Gemara almost explicitly saying? That the first command is counted as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Otherwise, how do you get that whole calculation? The math doesn't add up. So therefore, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, according to the Gemara, I am Hashem your God, is certainly a mitzvah. It's mitzvah number one. Mitzvah number two is don't have other gods. And then we've got 611 left for Moshe Rabbeinu to teach us. So the Bahak seems to be making sense, but the Gemara seems to be implying differently, that Anochi Hashem Elokecha is a mitzvah. So what's going on? And in fact, the Chinuch, the Sefer HaChinuch, which is another great sage, who enumerated all the 613 mitzvahs. He was a Spanish, I think, 13th century, right? Who wrote a book on trying to work out exactly the number 613, certainly counts Emunah, the existence of Hashem, as one of the mitzvahs. And he says, yes, the first mitzvah of the Torah is to believe in God. Right? So what do we do with this? Like, on the one hand, the Gemara seems to say it's a mitzvah. On the other hand, the Bahag seems to make sense. It happened to be a mitzvah by definition. It seems like a contradiction in terms. It can't be a mitzvah because you already accepted it as a God once you talk about a mitzvah. So what do we do with this? So one of the explanations comes from the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel was one of the Rishonim from Portugal. He was a great philosopher, a great writer, Machubish. He was born in Portugal and died in Venice. I think also around 13th century. He puts forward a thesis based on the Rambam, based on the writings of the Rambam, where the Rambam talks about the mitzvah and believing in God, which in turn is based on a Zohar, actually. Right? Which in itself is a fascinating discussion, because there's a whole discussion when the Rambam was in fact a Kabbalist or not, because some said the Rambam didn't study Kabbalah, only the Rambam did, the Rambam didn't. However, if you look in the Rambam's magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah, it's clear that some of the passages in the Rambam have no source in the Gemara, or in any of the earlier writings, and the only source seems to be the Zohar. So it's apparent that the Rambam did study at least some form of Kabbalah, and he certainly studied the Zohar. The Zohar discusses, and this is what I'm going to share with you now, is a combination of the Zohar, the Rambam, and the Abarbanel's explanation. The Zohar discusses the first mitzvah of the Torah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, but links it to another pasuk, and I'll show you where the pasuk is so you can look at it inside. Pasuk is in the beginning of Parshas Va'era, page 318. The pasuk Zion, verse 7. This is where God is telling Moshe Rabbeinu to tell the Jewish people, He will take them out of Egypt, He will save them, He will take them out, He will redeem them, etc. Then He says in pasuk Zion, in verse 7, yeah, okay. Got it? V'lakachti eschem li la'am, I will take you for a nation to me. V'hayisi lachem l'lakim, and I will be to you as a God. Vidatem ki ani Hashem Elokechem, you will know that I am Hashem your God. You will know that I am Hashem your God. Hamoitzi eschem, that has taken you out mitachas sivlois Mitzrayim, from the burdens of Egypt. God says that when you come out of Egypt, you will know that I am your God. What does the Torah mean? You will know that I am your God. What does that mean? What does the word yedia mean? Right. Says the Zohar that the statement of the first 10 commandments, I am Hashem your God, right, which is the mitzvah of believing in God, is actually the intention of this pasuk, is to be linked to that other pasuk, and you will know that I am God. What he says is that there's a big difference between believing in something or knowing something. Okay, yediyah, the word yediyah, there's different words, by the way, for knowing in Hebrew, like understanding, bina, wisdom, chokhmah. Das is knowledge. What does das actually mean? Das means not just to be aware consciously that something exists, but das means to internalize it, to understand it. And it means two things. What the word yediya means is this. Yediya means, first of all, not just to know it generally, but to know it specifically. In other words, if I am generally aware of something's existence, I don't know any details. I just know that it exists. Right? I know that computers exist. Computers work. I have a computer at home. It works. Right? Can I tell you that I know how computers work? No. Because I don't know any of the specifics. I don't know what the inside of a computer looks like. When mine breaks down, I call a doctor. Right? Computer doctor. So I don't have yediya. I'm aware that it works, but I can't tell you that I have a knowledge of it's working, right? Yediya means to know specifics, to know details, number one. Secondly, yediya, the word da'as, means to intellectualize, to understand as much as humanly possible. That's what yediya means. When you know something, it means you've internalized it. Intellectual. Says the Zohar, and this is very clear from the Rambam, because what the Rambam does at the very beginning of his book, he introduces the first mitzvah and he says, but he says it only after five paragraphs. He says, everything I've told you in the last five paragraphs is what's meant by the mitzvah of Anachi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God. What does he say in the first five paragraphs? In the first five paragraphs, the Rambam says that it's a mitzvah. The first mitzvah in the Torah is, not, he doesn't say the word believe. He says, Leda, to know. To know that there is a creator from whom everything exists, that he doesn't require anyone else's existence, but everything, all of existence requires him, that he is infinite, that he's omnipresent, that he's omnipotent, that he's a perfect being. You see details, right? And that, to know this and to understand this, is a mitzvah, the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And then he goes on throughout the chapter and he gives us tools, he gives us material to reflect on, to understand, to think about, and to internalize, intellectualize. Says that Barbanel that it's not a problem, this whole issue, this whole debate about whether Emunah is a mitzvah or not. He says that Bahag is right. To have a general awareness that there is an existence of a creator, that's not a mitzvah. That's an assumption, that's a foundation, that's an axiom you must accept before any mitzvah starts to exist. But when Hashem gave the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God, right? That wasn't just the mitzvah to be aware that there's a creator. That was of the mitzvah of V'yadaitem ki ani Hashem. You shall know that I am God. What was the mitzvah? The mitzvah was that a creator that you already accept his existence. Number one, you should be aware of the specifics. You should understand the perfection of his being. You should understand that he's infinite and he's omnipresent and he's omnipotent and he doesn't require any other existence and he's the source of everything, etc., etc. And you shall embark on a process where as much as is humanly possible, because of course God transcends our human logic, but as much as humanly possible, you intellectualize his existence. Not just to be aware that he exists, but you intellectualize his existence. You understand it, you reflect upon it, you think about it, you deduce it, you conclude it intellectually, you try to understand it with your human intellect as much as possible. That's the mitzvah. Right? Everyone's with me so far? So that's how he explains the first one of the Ten Commandments. He explains it fits in beautifully to the words of the Rambam, and it also resolves the whole issue. Is Anochi Hashem Elokecha a mitzvah? Yes, it is. But we have the question of the Baha'i, how can it be a mitzvah if we already assume there's an existence? The mitzvah is much deeper than that. The mitzvah is beyond Emunah. The mitzvah is to know, to exist, to intellectualize, to know its specifics. Okay.
Can I just ask, what sure. Seems it's a mitzvah that you never say bracha on?
Yeah, we never say a mitzvah on a bracha, that's a mindset mitzvah. We only say a bracha on a mitzvah that you have to do something. Plenty. Love of Hashem, fear of Hashem. There are six, actually. There are six mindset mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, okay. And they're constant. They're called the Shesh Mitzvahs Tamidiyas. They're constant mitzvahs. Okay. Now, that's the explanation of how it works, but what's the meaning behind this? What is the concept? The concept goes like this. We have, in fact, this is a theme, this is a pattern that runs throughout the whole Torah. I'll show you how in a minute. There's a concept of Emunah, and there's a concept of Yediyah, a concept of believing and a concept of understanding. And they both have an advantage the other one doesn't have. They both have a downside, they both have an upside. What is the meaning of Emunah? The word Emunah means the ability, when a person believes, what does belief mean? Belief means, what do you...
Faith.
Right. Well, no, faith is a sort of an extrapolation of the word emunah, but it does mean faith, but the word emunah really means like this. Let me define it for you. I can't translate it really, but the definition is like this. The definition of emunah means the ability to believe in something that is impossible to understand. That's why we use it for faith. For example, when, God forbid, a tragedy happens, or something happens we don't understand or we can't make any sense of, we say, well, we've got to have a munah. What does that mean? The munah is that God has a plan, God knows what he's doing, we don't understand him, he's beyond us, he's infinite. But we have a munah. A munah means we have the capacity, we have the ability to submit to something that's beyond us. So a munah, right, a munah means the ability to go beyond yourself, to go out of yourself, to connect to something that is totally beyond you. Because sort of the highest form of the human being is understanding, that's sort of what controls us as human beings, right? There was some secular philosopher that once said, I've forgotten who it was, I think, therefore I am, right? Which of course is, who was it, sorry?
Descartes,
okay. Which of course is a non-Jewish concept, because it's not true, because actually it's not our identity, but nevertheless, it's true in the sense that as human beings, we are intellectual human beings, that seems to drive our existence, but Emunah actually gives us the capacity to connect to something deeper than that and to connect to something which is beyond understanding, beyond human logic, right? And that's an amazing thing. And that's a gift that was given to us actually at the giving of the Torah, that we can believe in an infinite God. We can believe in the aspects of God and godliness that are beyond us, that are infinite, that are totally beyond the creation, because we have that Emunah, we have that concept, right? However, Emunah has a very big downside. Okay. Because, just listen to this, just try and follow me for a couple minutes. Emunah means that you negate yourself. In other words, you submit to something that isn't you. The problem with that is that it's not you. And therefore, when Emunah lives within you, it often is not integrated within your identity. I'll give you an example. Very often, Emunah, we all have Emunah, and very often it's very abstract and very detached from our real self. There's a famous line that's brought down in Kabbalah and in Hasidic literature about the thief. It's called, in Aramaic, it's called Ganva Pum Machtarte Rahman Akari, about the thief that davens to God just as he's about to make a break-in. And he says, please God, make me successful. Right? What's the idea? We laugh, but the truth is we all do this on different levels. We all believe. Everyone sitting on this table has belief. And yet, we all often do things that maybe God doesn't like. Right? At the same time, we believe in God. Why? Because belief means that you submit to something that's not you. The problem is it doesn't operate very well within you. So it's detached, it's abstract. The Ganeth, if you ask him, of course he believes in God. In fact, he believes that God's going to help him, but the fact that it should become part of his reality, part of his identity, that it should govern every part of his life, that belief in God should become part of who he is, which would obviously then prevent him from stealing, that hasn't happened, because it's like a detached thing. And Munah means he's allowed something that's not him into him, but he doesn't come part of him. Right? There's only one way for something to become part of your identity and part of your reality, and that is to understand it. To think about it. That it becomes part of the intellectual process. Right? When you think about something, when you intellectualize something, when you understand something, when you reflect on something, you meditate on a concept, then it becomes you, because your intellect is already you. That's already part of what you are. So the more you understand something, you understand it deeply, and you internalize it through understanding it properly, then it becomes your reality. The problem is that we dare not begin with understanding, because the human understanding is very limited. And therefore, if we begin with understanding, we'll never connect to an infinite God, because we're very limited, finite human beings. And that's the downside of intellectualization. And for that, yeah, is with me? Everyone's with me? And for that reason, Yiddishkeit is a combination of both. Yiddishkeit says what you need to do is you need to submit to something higher than your understanding. You need to negate yourself. You have to shut down and say, no, I'm not going to trust my limited, finite self, but I'm going to make myself open to a higher being, an infinite being that is beyond me completely. And the way you do that is through Emunah. Right? However, in order for that higher being to somehow connect to me, to my identity, to become my reality, I'm going to try then and think about it and internalize it and at least take the parts that are possible on some level to understand and understand as much as I possibly can. There will always be parts I don't understand, but at least understand what I could understand so that it becomes part of who I am. But the foundation has to be Emunah. Emunah has to come first. Emunah has to be first where I submit to something higher and then I try to make it part of who I am through intellectualizing. Through the concept of Yediyah. Right? Now, in truth, I've mentioned this before, but this is actually a theme that runs through the whole of Torah, if you think about it. Because you know that we have 613 mitzvahs, as we said. And the 613 mitzvahs could really be categorized as two types of mitzvahs, the ones we understand and the ones we don't understand. Chukim and Mishpatim. There are mitzvahs that are very logical, rational mitzvahs, and the mitzvahs that are totally beyond us. They don't make any sense, like the laws of Shatnez, the laws of Kashrus even. Right? According to most opinions, laws of kashrus is an irrational mitzvah. Yeah? Well, you thought it was healthy, didn't you?
No.
It was the last time you ate shmaltzeri. Shmaltzeri is very kosher, very unhealthy. So, yeah, nothing to do with health. But, no, it doesn't make sense. Well, why should we eat some things and other things? Yeah. Paraduma, the red cow, etc. Right? Many, many mitzvahs are totally beyond us. And the truth is that within every mitzvah we've got two aspects. There are aspects of mitzvah which are more understood, aspects of mitzvah which are not understood, right? Why did God do that? Why is that part of the divine design of mitzvahs? That same idea. Because we have to serve Hashem on those two levels at the same time. There's got to be things we do that we totally don't understand, because there's got to be submission. You've got to submit yourself to something that you don't understand. Otherwise you remain locked and trapped within your finite self. However, complete submission is also no good, because it never becomes part of who you are. It's something higher that you've let in, but it never became you. It never became your identity. The only way it can become your identity is by understanding it, internalizing it, enjoying it, appreciating it. And that's why there's some mitzvahs that were given to us specifically, so we should understand them. And we should appreciate them and intellectualize them so it becomes who we are. Right? And that's the first mitzvah of the Ten Commandments. That's the foundation of Matan Torah. Matan Torah is, of course, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, like the Chinuch says, is a mitzvah of emunah, belief. You've got to believe in an infinite God, whether you understand or not. You've got to be totally, totally subservient and total submission. But says the Zohar and the Rambam that no, that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to take it a lot further than that. The mitzvah is the yidaitem. You should also know that God. Understand the specifics, understand the perfect existence, understand and intellectualize as much as is humanly possible, so that the emunah, the belief in that one God, actually becomes part of your reality. Okay? If that concept is understood, now we can go back to the very beginning. Now we can understand what was the greatness of Naaseh V'Nishma. The Gemara says that Naaseh V'Nishma was so great because they said Naaseh before Nishma. But as I said before, that wasn't the greatest of Naaseh V'Nishma only. The greatest was that they also said Nishma because they got two gifts, one corresponding to Naaseh, one corresponding to Nishma. So you must say that the greatness of Naaseh V'Nishma was not only the pledge of discipline, the pledge of subservience to God's will, whether we understand or not. Part of the greatness of Naaseh V'Nishma, in addition to saying Naaseh before Nishma, was also Nishma. And now we can understand it very simply. Because Naaseh V'Nishma, in that order, is this concept. Naaseh means subservience. I will do whatever you tell me to do before I've listened, before I've understood. Emunah. I will submit myself to your will, whether I understand or not. That's total trust, total emunah. However, part of my pledge is, part of my commitment is, that I will not leave it there. But I will actually try and understand as much as I can. I will have the Nishma. The Nishma will follow the Naaseh, will not, God forbid, come before the Naaseh, because then I'm in trouble. But it will be there. The Nishma will be there. And the Nishma is as vital as the Naaseh, provided it comes after the Naaseh. Because you've got to make it part of who you are. It's got to become part of your reality. It's got to become part of your identity. And therefore learning is so important. That's why we have a mitzvah called Talmud Torah. We have a mitzvah called learning Torah. That's why it is so critical to learn Torah. Because learning Torah by definition is, you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of, or at least for most of it, you don't fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah unless you understand what's going on. Why should we learn? You know, there were many societies throughout history where learning was discouraged, you know that? I mean, that's a historic fact. The masses were illiterate because it was much easier to control the masses if they didn't learn. It was much easier for the clergy to understand what's going on and for the masses to follow blindly. Following blindly is a great commitment. That's the commitment of Naaseh. But the Torah doesn't want you to follow blindly, because the Torah wants it to become part of who you are. If you just have subservience, if you just have submission, you're submitting to something else, but it never becomes you. And therefore you must have the Nishma as well. And that's why throughout Torah history there was never such a thing. The obligation of learning Torah was always there for everyone. The obligation of trying to understand as much as we can about God was always there for everyone. The mitzvah, according to the Rambam, of emunah, but more than emunah, yediyah, was always there for everyone. Because you've got to make God part of who you are, and that's only through intellectualization, through understanding, through learning.
But it's only recent that women have been learning, so is Nishma also obligated on women? Because women kind of, till recently, were illiterate and didn't learn. And they were just kind of at home doing it.
No. Women always had... there's no question of the halachic obligation for learning Torah for women was always different to men, and still is, halachically. Mm-hmm. Although today, it's much more encouraged people to learn. But there was always a mitzvah for women to learn about the halachas that they need to keep. And one of the mitzvahs that women need to keep is emunah. Mm-hmm. So the mitzvah of yediyas Hashem was always there. Knowing, this concept of knowing God.
Informal teaching in the home rather than...
Okay, so then you're right. So whatever format
it is. Still learning.
True.
Yeah, okay.
That concept of knowing, that concept of internalizing, of course, was much there. Right? And that's why we have Naaseh V'Nishma. Now we can understand what the Gemara says, that the 600,000 angels came down and gave the Jews two gifts, two crowns, one for Naaseh, one for Nishma. Not just for Naaseh, because Nishma was equally as important, provided it was said in the right order, that Naaseh came before Nishma. That the commitment was to be subservient no matter what, no matter whether we understand or not, but there was a commitment to understanding at the same time on an equal level. And therefore, going back to the beginning of the shul, it comes every Shavuos. So Shavuos, we re-experience the Matan Torah, right? The Medrash says that when you come to shul, one should make an effort to come to shul on the first day of Shavuos, listen to the Ten Commandments. When we come and we listen to the Baal Kor reading the Ten Commandments, the Medrash says, it says, if we're standing at Har Sinai once again, accepting the Torah, that's quite a dramatic thing. And that's why it's good to listen to them in shul on the first day of Shavuos. But when we do that, it's not just a matter of listening to the Ten Commandments, it's a matter of trying to re-experience the whole idea of Matan Torah and trying to re-experience that commitment to Matan Torah. And that commitment is a double commitment. It's a commitment to the observance of mitzvahs, of a discipline, of subservience, of belief in God, whether we understand or not. But it's an equal commitment to Nishma, to learning, to understanding and learning Torah, which of course is the whole concept of the Festival of Shavuos. Good. Thank you.